You may not think humans have much in common with bugs, right? But as biologist E.O. Wilson points out in his new book, together we are the two conquerors of the earth, and the common thread, our social nature. This hour, E.O. Wilson joins us to talk about the evolution of complex societies, both ant and human, and how that helped us succeed, the subject of his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth. Plus a peek into Dr. Wilson's office.
This is Ant Central.
This week's video pick, a desktop diary. And then some genetic time traveling from katydids to horseshoe crabs. How can genes of some creatures tell us about life on Earth hundreds of millions of years ago? Some answers on your questions after the break, so stay with us. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's easy to assume that we humans rule the Earth. After all, we can clear-cut forests, we can chop the tops off mountains, we can harvest anything we want from the land or the sea. But before we get too cocky, let's not forget about those other titans of the Earth, the bugs. Take ants, for example. My next guest, who may be the world's greatest ant expert, estimates the number of ants living on Earth today to be 10 to the 16th power. That's 10,000 trillion ants. And he says if you put them all on a scale, they'd weigh about as much as all of the world's humans. Can you believe that? But how did ants and humans, such different creatures, both evolve complex societies? And is that the key to our success? Are our instincts, are your culture and your instincts part of your genes? Just a couple of the questions my next guest, Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson, writes about in his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth. He's professor emeritus at Harvard University in Cambridge. He joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be back with you.
Your book is called The Social Conquest of Earth, and in it you call humans and insects the two conquerors of Earth. What made us both so successful?
That's a question of questions. You know, it hasn't been addressed much by scientists, and of course, probably not at all by social scientists and others. We have now begun a new line of investigation. And we've developed a new theory of the origin of very advanced social systems like those of ants and bees and wasps on one side that are the dominant forms ecologically among the little things of the Earth and ourselves. We have a couple of questions we need to answer. One is that if those advanced conditions of social organization, which we call eusociality, we could define it in a moment if you like, but if they are so immensely successful, why are they so rare in the course of evolution? Why did they take so long to appear? We're just newcomers, of course, and the social insects that are so dominant around the world on the land didn't show up until well into the Mesozoic, the age of dinosaurs. Before that, there were no creatures like us, either among them or among the bigger animals. So what's the answer to that? We had to develop a new theory which encompassed other things, but also encompassed the possibility to answer that key question.
Mm-hmm. And what is your new theory?
At the foundation, I and a number of others have been seeing for years that there were big problems with the reigning theory, which is called kin selection, theory of kin selection. It has another name, theory of inclusive fitness, but kin selection is the one that's familiar to most people who've taken courses or read about this subject. It's been around for 40 years, but it was showing its age. It was able to seemingly predict some things, but it wasn't able to predict very much, and even the things it predicted seemed not a very good fit after all. Mm-hmm. And so it was necessary. What happened was that the new theory, the old theory, emphasized the relationship between kin, particularly closely related kin, that forms a nucleus of the formation of a very advanced society, and that sort of friendliness, altruistic reciprocity between close kin was the key to how social behavior came about, including very high social behavior.
In other words, if you had a lot of kin around you, you behaved well and kind,
yes, that's right,
toward them.
Yeah, that was a selfish gene.
The selfish gene.
In other words, a sacrifice for your brother or your aunt or whatever close kin you have around you. And if you lose in the Darwinian race, I mean, you leave fewer children as a result of that altruistic behavior, leave in the next generation fewer, then it doesn't matter because the close relative has the same genes as you by common descent, and therefore the traits that made you altruistic can evolve in a strict Darwinian manner. That's why it was sometimes called the selfish gene theory. Mm-hmm. Well, that has, for reasons that I think we could spend the rest of the hour discussing, has largely fallen very far short. Key evidence that was thought to support it has proved not to be true, and it just hasn't lived up to the demands of a really good theory, which is that if a good theory fits a lot of facts and it points clearly to new lines of investigation. The new theory, actually, it's a piecing together of elements that have been with us for some time, and we built up to it, not just through my thinking, certainly, but through the efforts of quite a few people, is that kin selection is not important. I mean, it can occur, but it's most likely would lead to nepotism. It's not an important factor. And whereas group selection had been marginalized in the kin selection scheme, that is, the competition among groups of individuals and the outcome of that competition in altruism that results in group superiority when group is pitted against group. That was marginalized, but now we see that that was a big mistake. Kin selection is not a key factor. Group selection combined with individual classical Darwinian selection, that is, you know, people competing with other people within the same group, that is the key, and now we're back to re-examining group selection, group versus group, in a wholly new way, and it's been yielding new ideas and information already very fast.
Mm-hmm. So then in this theory, the group then seeks to help itself out rather than the working between one-on-one kin. It's all the members of the group that are helping each other succeed.
There's a way of comparing a group and individual level selection. People understand immediately individual level selection.
Right.
Group selection is not hard either. And the little formula that we use just to sort of sum it all up to make it clearer is that within groups, selfish individuals beat altruists. But between groups, groups of altruists beat groups of selfish people. So both of those are operating simultaneously, and you can see they're operating in contest with one another. It's a conflict between those two levels. Mm-hmm. That means that within a very complex society, certainly including human societies, you have a conflict in individuals. You have a lack of a stable point at which individual welfare and, if you want to call it, selfishness cannot be expunged, and neither can altruism be expunged without respectively dissolving the society into just a bunch of competing individuals on one end or a robotic ant-like society on the other end.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with E.O. Wilson, author of The Social Conquest of Earth. Your idea was not well greeted, if I recall, when you published that paper in 2010. Around 150 scientists wrote into Nature taking issue with this idea, did they not?
Yeah, not at all unexpected, because there were quite a few people whose research was bound up in or dependent upon applications of kin selection theory. But as I said, it's a theory that wasn't working very well. It was spinning its wheels. And Yes, I expected a very strong blowback. I knew how it would go, but we do not do science by polls. And if those who have been developing elements of the theory and beginning to express and explore it were to be polled, I mean, you formed a caucus of them, it would include some of the leading experts on the various subjects that are most affected by the theory. Experts on social insects, experts on the theory of evolution at different levels, and so on.
1-800-989-8255. Let me see if I can get a quick phone call before the break. Peter in Berkeley, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you. It's quite an honor. And thanks for that show on space, by the way. I wondered if Dr. Wilson could comment on what he's just said about the kin selection versus altruistic reciprocity or altruistic reciprocity between close kin and groups. What would be the prescription for a peaceful world? Would it be some kind of universal civic values alliance, perhaps, that would spread this altruism to the group as a whole, the whole human race?
All right, let me get an answer.
I know he's thought about this.
Yeah, coming up on a good question. You write about this in the book a little bit.
Yes, right. My take on it is that there isn't any simple formula. We never expected a simple formula in settling down humanity on this planet because so much of our behavior is inherently conflicted at the individual level and, of course, in between group relationships. We just have too long and solid a history of contravention of one form of selection by the other. The group selection pressure is what made us. It's also the pressure that's most dangerous, because although it makes us altruistic within the group, it also makes groups very easily turn against other groups. So I'm dodging your question, and I am. But let me just put it this way. Before we solve a problem, just as in medicine and in engineering, anything, we have to define what the problem is precisely, and we have to find out what might be the ways to get a solution. And in this case, the solution to finding, say, a more peaceful global community is to diagnose what we are.
Okay,
that
let
is
me
to
let,
say,
let,
what
let
are
me...
we? Yeah, what is the human species, and where do we come from? We need to have better self-understanding.
All right, we're going to take a break on that very deep thought for you to think about while we're in the break, talking with E.O. Wilson, author of The Social Conquest of Earth. 1-800-989-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with E.O. Wilson, author of The Social Conquest of Earth, our number 1-800-989-8255. And Dr. Wilson was saying that before we can solve our problems, we have to know who we are. Is it possible to know who we are?
I think it is. I think most people would agree that the two questions, where do we come from and what are we? I like to use the word what are we as a better, more distant way of asking the question. We have to answer those two questions. They are the central questions of religion and philosophy. That's what makes them in part so difficult, because there have been so many takes by the creation stories of different religions and by philosophers struggling to figure out what the mind is and so on. But now I think we can cut through more quickly with the aid of science, and science from many disciplines that range all the way from molecular genetics to archaeology and then on beyond into history, to begin to settle on what an answer is. And certainly we are a work in progress, but when we say that, we need to know why we went so far as we did. I don't want to get long-winded about it, just to say the following, and we can expatiate on that if you want, but the following is the interesting fact that came clear to me when we try to when we review what it is we know about the course of evolution of the forms that became very advanced in social organization, including humans. And there is one final step that was attained and then taken by every one of the roughly 24 instances of which we have knowledge in the history of life that went to the extreme high level of social insects in humans. And that final stage was to be a solitary individual building nest sites that were valuable, that were defensible, in which the individuals raised the young progressively by going out, finding food, and bringing it and feeding to the young until they matured. When you reach that stage, it's just one short step over to this advanced state of eusociality, and that can be attained by a very small genetic change. But what it means when it does happen is that group selection has to then enter the picture and overwhelm or at least compromise individual-level selection. That's the formula, and I hope that was not too unclear.
No, that was,
but that's how we are approaching the problem now.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book that we're a mix of genes, some altruistic, some individualistic. Does that mix of genes describe what we know as human nature? What is human nature?
I think it does. In other words, if you there are two properties of human beings that we really don't acknowledge much. I mean, in the sense of taking some more distant view and saying what is peculiar about Homo sapiens that enter into this. One is that we are extremely groupish. People intensely desire to belong to groups, identify themselves with those groups, and consider their groups to be superior to comparable competing groups, and they may be overlapping, and they are interacting, and this is what we do. We are a group-forming species. But in addition, we are intensely interested in what other people are doing and thinking. And this is something the cognitive psychologists have come out with pretty clearly in recent years, that people are superb, all of us geniuses, at reading the intentions of others in order to get cooperation, to develop dominance, bonding, and so on. And that is what is called social intelligence. That's a consequence of group selection and is probably a hallmark of human behavior.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that the most advanced groups, the most advanced colonies, ants, or humans, are the ones that evolve the most altruistic behavior?
They have. It's not easy to be an altruist. And because there's always that countervailing pressure not to be an altruist. So in any society, and that's endemic. That means that we'll never get over that conflicted nature. But that's not so bad if we can learn to live with our complex personal motivations like that, which are endowment from the way the human species was created starting back about 3 million years ago. And we should keep in mind that plus the two dominant features of the human social condition that I just mentioned is the stuff of our humanities. That's what we do within the humanities. We tell stories. We dwell upon our histories. We look endlessly through novels and biographies into all the details of bonding, deception, tyranny, reversal of fortune, and the like. All of this is made up out of permutations of those features that are unique to our form of social behavior.
So then there is a part of our evolution of our genes toward altruism?
Yes.
That makes us successful.
It is, but it does have its compromises, and I'm afraid that those compromises are the difficulty of our moral decisions.
Please expound on that a bit. Compromises.
Yes, because every decision that a person makes, I'm now talking to something everybody knows and may not wish to even hear again, every decision that a human being makes entails a competition between reflection on individual interest in the consequences and the social interest in the consequences, even if those social interests are known or expressed to the person in his calculation by laws and rules and moral strictures. So we are always, in every decision we make, particularly social decision, having to play those two forces one against the other. And so that's why moral reasoning is such a complicated and difficult matter. Our decisions then, in the midst of this conflict, which is inborn, that's the point I want to make, and is responsible for making us highly social in the first place, has to be thought out in contexts, and also it has to be thought out through time, long-term consequences and short-term consequences, and that's what makes being human so difficult, and why philosophers ponder so long and laboriously on the whole matter of moral reasoning, trying to get rules and patterns out of it that can serve us as a kind of guidebook.
Let me go to the phones. Robert in Salisbury, Maryland. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hi. Fantastic discussion you're having. just one quick question, comment. I believe your theory has been proven correct 100% by what's happening now. With society has bonded through mass communication methods, and it looks like that will be the way to overthrow anything which seems to be socially unacceptable, whether it's governmental or whatever. And as you said earlier on, moral decisions are inborn, and it looks like the use of Facebook or whatever, Twitter, whatever, for mass communication will bond society against evil. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Well, hard to comment on that except to say, yes, that's some of the fine detail of what we do and how we work out our day-to-day existence.
So you believe we're at a sort of a turning point then for our society and our evolution?
Not necessarily. I think what we are is at a turning point in the sense of having, one, a much better knowledge of where we came from. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be teaching that and investigating it as just part of routine education. And second, what are we and why from that history and from where all we know of how our brain works and the like, what we are. And then we're going to be in a situation, of course we are at the turning point, and we are right on the edge of, we're in the early stage of techno-scientific revolution, where we are becoming essentially a global community in constant and minute communication. That'll change the arena somewhat, but it's not going to change our human nature or our ability to deal with our problems without a lot of calculation and without a lot of background knowledge.
But your research and your ideas are saying that if we want to stay a successful large community, we have to think altruistically. All of us together.
That's correct.
And that's what your research with ants and your research with people have shown, that if we evolve toward altruism, we'll stay successful. That means we have to get all the different parts of the world working. If there is truly, we're now through social communities combining a lot of the different various parts of the world into a larger colony, bigger nest.
Oh, don't use that metaphor.
Nest
I know
is
what
wrong.
You mean, but we don't want to become ants, surely. We want to be as fractious and quarrelsome and and uncertain and dithering from now on, but we just want to do it with more wisdom and making better decisions. But basically, again, as I say, I think the time has come to put together and to put as part of education what a host of scientists ranging in their separate interests, all the way from molecular genetics through to portion to the social sciences, actually, to take what they have are putting together with increasing clarity and make that basic to our understanding mm-hmm. of ourselves. We're not teaching anything like that now, even teaching it with critiques. So I hope to see that change. I hope soon.
All right, hang on with us, because joining us now is our multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman, to talk about, you recall she made a visit to your office, Dr. Wilson, and she filmed you there. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira. Hi, Dr. Wilson.
Hello.
Yes, this week, our video pick of the week this week is part of this series called Desktop Diaries, and this week's was a tour of Dr. Wilson's desk and office. He graciously let us camp out for a few hours. And I'll just set the scene a little bit, but Dr. Wilson, feel free to jump in and correct me. So you walk in, and on one side of the hallway is the biggest ant collection in the world. And I think you said maybe 1 million specimens of ants?
Yeah, about that. If you have volunteers, we can get the exact figure.
Well, yeah, call. I'm sure the phone lines are lighting up for that.
Right. There's a lot of Googling going on.
And yeah. Then on the other side of is your office and another type of collection. You have an enormous number of sort of ant-related paraphernalia. And I wondered, where did all that stuff, we never asked you while we were there, where did most of that come from?
From people all around the world. It's apparently that when friends want to, you know, give me a birthday gift, or somebody I've hosted wants to send a thank you note, or I go somewhere and I give a lecture, I get a new sculpture or photograph of an ant. So I've got a wonderful collection there, and I can't bear to throw a single one of them away.
Well, that explains it. It really is a beautiful collection, and you can see it on our website at sciencefriday.com. And as I was listening to you talk, it occurred to me that maybe Desktop Diaries, our interest in other people in this way, has something to do with our genes, too. You said that maybe, you know, that we're really social. I wonder, do you think that's why we like biographies and like sort of a human take on stories?
Actually, yes. I was just saying, and I'm not, this is not just my perception or off the top of my head. This is what cognitive psychologists like Michael Tomasello, who's done brilliant work in this area, but many others as well, are showing, is that we are about as intensely interested in other people minute by minute, and just about the most gossipy conceivable species that you can imagine being produced on any planet. These are extraordinary qualities we have, and I think they're to the good. So, by all means, keep up these interviews and stories in depth and so on.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here with Flora Lichtman and with E.O. Wilson, author of The Social Conquest of Earth. And Flora's, you took a visit and created a video this week. It's our video pick of the week, A Desktop Diary.
Yeah, go feed your humanness with A Desktop Diary this week.
Dr. Wilson, did your desk change over the years? Or is it over?
My what?
Your desktop. My desk? Has it changed over the years?
No, I've kept that pretty clear.
Yeah?
Otherwise, you know what happens. I don't know about your desktop, but I keep mine clear.
One thing we heard a little bit about is how you stumbled upon ants a very long time ago. Can you give us that story? You said you were 9, I think.
Yeah, I was glad to do that because I just 2 days ago addressed the TED Med organization in Washington at the Kennedy Skinner Center. And what I wanted, I dealt with, and we were able to treat very nicely, is the message to a young scientist. In fact, that's what I'm doing now, if I can intrude that. I'm writing a book called Letters to a Young Scientist. And now I realize, looking back, I could use my own story out of one of thousands that could be used. I started an interest in ants and butterflies and things like that when I was about 9 years old. I had a bug period, and I think most kids do, and I just never grew out of it. I saw myself when I wandered off into the woods with a butterfly net at an early age as Frank Buck or some kind of adventurer or adventurer-to-be entering the jungles of distant lands and learning all about the creatures that lived in them. I think it's a basic human archetype that we tend to follow or can follow very easily. And out of that, I became a scientist. If we collected all the stories of scientists and whatever profession you really would like to understand more deeply, I think it would profit us a lot to, how would she say it, excavate by testimony and an examination just how it all got started and where those commitments came from.
Well, you've added to that library that we collect each week from scientists about that, and I want to thank you very much and wish you the best of luck. The Social Conquests of Earth by E.O. Wilson. You have a talent for describing things and knowing how hard it is for us to understand them and repeating them in your text, and we thank you for that, Dr. Wilson. And good luck with your work and your next book. We'll look forward to that.
All right. Thanks, Ara.
Thank you for allowing us, and thank you, Flora, for the desktop diary.
Thank you.
It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can take a look at it and download it on your iPhone or your Android app and enjoy it and share it with everybody else. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flato.
Speak Spanish? Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. Up next, if you're at work right now, chatting, planning your next Facebook update, stuck in traffic, maybe all three, I've got some news that you can use. We've got a candidate for your dream job, and Flora Lichtman is here to tell us more about it. Flora?
Here's the job description. You travel to the world's most beautiful and exotic places. We're talking the tropical rainforests of New Guinea, the succulent-covered mountains of South Africa, and your mission is to look for the most amazing creatures on the planet. I'm talking about katydids with pink eyes, walking sticks the color of indigo, frogs the size of a pea. And then you get to research them, photograph them, and write about them. That sounds pretty good. Well, Peter Nascrecki is living proof that dream jobs do exist. Dr. Nascrecki is a research associate at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University. He's an entomologist, a photographer, and a writer. And his latest book is called Relics, Travels in Nature's Time Machine. And it's where you can find photos of those katydids and frogs. And you can also find them on our website at sciencefriday.com/arts. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Nascrecki.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me here.
So what is a relic?
Relic, it's a concept that it's somewhat fuzzy in terms of defining it. But what it essentially means is it's a relic is an organism that it's usually the last remaining member of a very, very old lineage of organisms, organisms that go back millions of years ago, organisms that used to flourish, were widely distributed, but then something happened and they largely disappeared. And you have only these few remaining hangers-on that tell us something about how life evolved, how organisms have changed over the years. And they are these precious relics of the evolution of life on Earth.
I think people have heard the term living fossil, which has always kind of confused me because
good reason.
Okay, good, because it seems like if you're either living or you're a fossil. But you explain to me what the problem is.
Yes, biologists don't use the term living fossil anymore. This is it's a very kind of historically loaded term. It was first introduced by Charles Darwin, and that's why people were kind of reluctant to abandon it. But the living fossil doesn't really, it's not really definable. We have to remember that all currently living species are of about the same age. There are no miracle survivors that lived for millions and millions of years. All species are about a million, maybe 2 or 3 million years old. The living fossil was this kind of a mental shortcut to talk about organisms that resemble these long gone and extinct ancestors of currently living species, but living fossils do not really exist. And that's why biologists more frequently use the term relicts and more precisely phylogenetic relics to talk about organisms that represent these old and largely disappeared lineages.
Let's talk about some of the relics that you detail in this beautiful book. One that I really enjoyed reading about and had never heard of was the Tuatara. What is that?
Oh, Tuatara, that's a very special animal. Tuatara is the last living member of a group of reptiles that are called Sphenodontia. Sphenodontia were abundant and widely distributed in the Jurassic and Cretaceous. They were contemporaries of dinosaurs, and you could find their fossils pretty much all over the world. Some of them were aquatic. They were called plesiosaurs. Others were terrestrial. But then something happened, and that thing that happened was the appearance and subsequent radiation of modern lizards. And modern lizard turned out to be far better and competing for natural resources than Tuatara relatives. And they largely disappear, Tuatara relatives. And the only place in the world where you can still find one is the island of New Zealand. And that was a kind of a historical strike of luck for this lineage, because New Zealand has been completely isolated from any other land masses for at least 80 million years. And by the sheer luck of being so isolated, they were able to survive.
Oh, so it's not actually anything about their specific genetic makeup. It's just their location?
Well, it's a combination of both. I cannot put the exact number on it, but my personal feeling is that 90% of it was just pure luck. But at the same time, they do have elements of their biology that are very helpful in surviving long term. For example, Tuataras do very well in cold temperatures. New Zealand is not the warmest place in the world, and yet they flourish in those low temperatures. They are the reptiles with the lowest optimal temperature of any reptile currently living. They can do very well when the temperature drops to decidedly nippy 50s or so. and so that gives them kind of a competitive edge over other reptiles. There are other reptiles on New Zealand. There are geckos and there are skinks, but they cannot simply compete with the Tuatara because of its ability to be active in the cold temperature.
So just to make sure that I have this straight, though, the relics, they do, evolutionary forces are still acting upon them, right?
Absolutely.
These aren't exactly the same as what you would have found millions of years ago.
They are not. They are not. The thing that is special about relics, think of them as carrying the versions 1.0 or even better versions of structures or combinations of genes that have later evolved. Most other organisms will have versions 2.0 or 3.0 of certain body elements, but they still retain those fairly early versions, and that's why they are so valuable. They tell us, using these relics, we can more easily reconstruct the evolution of individual lineages of organisms. So let's take this Tuatara again. If we look at the skeleton of the Tuatara, we will see elements in that skeleton that tells us how the skeleton of reptiles have changed and evolved. They have very primitive skull. They have very primitive a spine, and they have elements of their rib cage that cannot be found anymore in any other reptiles, but those elements were found, for example, in dinosaurs. So again, they carry these old elements in their morphology, in their physiology, or in their genes that tell us about how life has evolved and changed.
If you want to get in on this conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. You can ask about these relics. So, Peter, how do you get these incredible photos when you're going to these really remote places?
Well, I have a very expensive camera. No, but seriously, the main element, of course, is patience, a lot of patience, and it really helps to have knowledge about these organisms. I know what to expect from them. I know how they will likely behave. But it all essentially boils down to sitting still and waiting patiently for something to happen and not scaring the animals.
And I was wondering if we have a lot of great nature photographer listeners, and we know this because we've done sort of photography contests. Are there any shortcuts? I'm always looking for a trick to getting a good or rules to live by when you're out in the field photographing.
Learn about your subject. The more you know about your subject, the easier it will be for you to take a good photo of that subject. And it applies, both to landscapes and weather, but also to plants and animals. If you know what time of the day this particular plant will bloom, then you are more likely to get a great photo. If you know about the weather pattern of the place, you also will be far more likely to get an interesting dramatic shot. But this, of course, applies primarily to animals. If you know what time of day this particular animal is active and how it responds to your presence, that all will help you incredibly. I don't think there is one simple shortcut to getting a better natural history photos, unfortunately.
As usual.
as usual.
But you don't actually have to go far from home, right? In this book, you do go to beautiful places, but also your own backyard.
Absolutely not. That's the thing that was probably the most satisfying about writing this book. When I started writing it a few years ago, I thought that I will have to travel far and away to look for these ancient members of these ancient lineages. And only later it occurred to me that all I have to do is just kind of open my mind and look with a certain amount of knowledge at the surroundings of my own house, and I'll find some incredible things. I live near Boston, probably about 5 miles from my house, you can see living members of one of the oldest lineages of animals on the planet, things that are over 500 million years old, and they still flourish in the woods around Boston. And I'm talking about this little crustacean known as fairy shrimp. These are pre-Cambrian animals. We have fossils of those things that date back 500 million years, and you can still see them around you, where you live.
They're hatching right now, right?
Now it's time to see them. You will see them in these little bodies of water known as vernal pools. As the snow melts, the water accumulates at the bottom of a little holes in the ground, in usually in forests, and that's where you find fairy shrimp. They are little animals, no longer than half of your pinky finger, but they are stunningly beautiful if you look at them up close. And their biology is just absolutely riveting. They encompass in their biology and behavior everything that you need to be the ultimate survivor. By studying their biology, you can finally understand what it takes to stay alive and not go extinct like so many other lineages of organisms.
Well, this is news we can use. What does it take to stay alive?
Well, I think there's of course not one unifying feature of all these relic organisms, but there is one commonality, and that's to be flexible. If you can adapt, if you can change a little bit your biology, if you are not a specialist, then you are far more likely to survive. And in the case of these little fairy shrimp, they have evolved a life strategy that is just incredibly incredibly flexible. They can survive for years without water in these little what's called cysts, the sort of a suspended animation. They reproduce very, very quickly, and they reach maturity very, very quickly. And they also kind of hedge their bets. So even when the conditions are very, very good, not all the eggs will hatch. Only some of them will hatch because the water can suddenly disappear. And so they always kind of keep this kind of cache of eggs that can sometimes last up to 8 years to wait for the proper conditions. And so this flexibility in your life history is a common trait of these ancient lineages. And Another good example of a relic that's, to me, is one of the most fascinating animals on the planet is the horseshoe crab. Horseshoe crabs, which we can also see on the east coast of North America. The greatest aggregation of them is in the Delaware Bay. These animals have survived since the Ordovician, again, 450 million years. And during that time, many seemingly more imposing lineages, such as trilobites or even dinosaurs, disappeared. And the key to the survival of horseshoe crabs is, again, that they are extremely flexible. Mm. They can survive in the freshwater, in the saltwater, in cold waters, in tropical waters, and so on. Mm. So that's the key. Be flexible.
You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman. I'm here with Ira Flato and Peter Nascrecki, who is the author of Relics, Travels in Nature's Time Machine. Now, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about were these organisms called Blatodines.
Blatodians, yes.
Blatodians.
Yes. It's not a commonly used term. Only entomologists really use it.
Well, I'm glad to know how to say it, though. They were fascinating. They nurse. These are insects that, I think I have it right, that nurse their young?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Blatodians is a fascinating lineage of animals that we can use to look at the evolution of parental care and maternal care in animals. And their behavior spans a wide range from very, very simple behavior when the female just lays her eggs and let them hatch and fend for themselves, through the stages where the female actually carry the eggs and wait until the little nymphs or larvae hatch. Then we have species in which the female will actually take care of them, but by simply protecting them, she will carry them on her back. And then we have species in which the female develops an equivalent of a placenta, just like the mammals do. So she will carry them in her body to term, and the little ones hatch fully formed and ready to start an independent life. But the most fascinating example of maternal care in these Blatodians is that some species have developed mammary glands, just like mammals. The female has a series of little glands on the underside of her abdomen, and she actually suckles her young. That's the only other case of suckling in the animal kingdom. Only the Blatodians and only the only mammals do that. So to me, that's absolutely fascinating that in this little-known group of insects, we have complexity of parental behavior that rivals our own.
Amazing. You can see a picture of a Blatodian on our website, by the way, if you're curious. So I wanted to ask you, we have, I think, time for just one quick more question, and that is that, you know, this book is filled with insects, and I wondered, Relics, Travels in Nature's Time Machine. And I wondered if you feel like, you have a mission to sort of give a voice or expose the underdogs of the animal kingdom.
Yes, you are right. I do feel like I have a mission. Most of life on Earth are these little things that we pay no attention to. And they receive very, very little attention from, most of the human population. And, there are very few people, relatively few people like me, who care about these little things. So I always try to bring them to light and tell people about their fascinating biology behavior and show their beauty. I mean, we humans are sort of handicapped by our own size. We are one of the rare giants surrounded by this smaller majority of organisms. And in my work, I try to enlarge them or bring them to our own level so we can appreciate their diversity. And also at the same time, because I'm also a conservation biologist, to show that a lot of them do need our help to survive. They have lasted for so many millions of years, and now they are on the verge of extinction because of our carelessness. So that's one of the reasons for this book.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You have at least one convert in this studio. Dr. Nascrecki is a research associate at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard and the author of Relics, Travels in Nature's Time Machine.
Our program's senior producer is Ed Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Namisha Serena Anand and Luis Quevedo. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch is our technical director. But Manoli Weatherall is here at the controls in New York. Our iPhone app is created by the folks at Pastime Software. And if you missed any part of it, you can get it on that app, an iPhone or our Android app, or download our podcast and subscribe to them, audio and video. And we'll have our video pick of the week up there this week also. So you can go to our website, and we'll be tweeting all week at SciFri, S-C-I-F-R-I. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.